Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the Blair-Bush summit, and we'll be speaking with Dr. Benjamin Barber, who is a distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland and a principal in the Democracy Collaborative. He is the author of the recent international bestseller Jihad versus McWorld and a more recent bestseller, Fear's Empire, War, Terrorism, and Democracy. And we'll speak then with Robert Malley, who is a Middle East and North Africa Program Director at the International Crisis Group. Robert Malley served as a special assistant to President Clinton for Arab, Israeli affairs, and prior to that, he was executive assistant to Samuel Berger, the National Security Advisor. And he was also on the National Security Council as the Director of for Democracy, Human Rights, and Humanitarian Affairs. We're talking to him about the Bush-Olmert, the Israeli Prime Minister's meeting earlier in last week, in which the President, seemingly off the cuff, offered a treaty with Israel. So we'll be looking into that. And then we'll talk with a couple of Iraq war veterans on Memorial Day. We'll be speaking to a veteran who participated in the build-up to the bombing, build-up to the war in the intensified bombing campaign in the fall of 2002. He went back to Iraq as a civilian in January of 2004. And he's the co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. He'll also be joined by a veteran who's still in the California National Guard, having just returned in October of last year from an 11-month deployment in Iraq. Let's begin now with the subject of the meeting that took place this week between Tony Blair and President Bush. The Economist magazine had a caption and a cover picture of both of them, referring to them as the axis of the feeble. Ben Barber, it was an extraordinary sight to see the president, the most powerful leader of the most of the lone superpower, and the head of Britain, which used to be a superpower and still has some international standing, basically enfeebled, brought down by a country of 25 million people, largely desert. There was a tinge of pathos to it, I thought.
Well, Ian, how the times change. I'm not quite sure it's fair to say that a country of 25 million brought them down. I think the United States and Bush and Blair brought themselves down, really, by pursuing unthought, unthinkable policies in a country they didn't really understand, pursuing a war whose goals were never clear and whose outcome was predicted by, in fact, the current Vice President of the United States over 15 years ago as an absolutely unwinnable, destabilizing war. Dick Cheney, when he was Secretary of Defense in the first Bush administration, that is to say Bush Pair, the father, actually said at the time when he advised they not pursue the Guard all the way back to Baghdad in the first Gulf War, he said, we can't go in there. If we overthrow Hussein, we're going to end up with a civil war and an insurgency where America can't possibly win. So he knew that back in 91. He must have forgotten it 10, 12 years later. And the fact is it's really been the United States with Blair in tow that has pursued a disastrous strategy that has allowed Iraq to become a quagmire and also a tragedy for the people of Iraq itself.
Ben Barber, with the Democracy Collaborative, you spent a lot of time in Europe meeting with European leaders and government officials, and it appears that a number of European leaders, including the new German leader and some of the elder statesmen here in the United States, Henry Kissinger, Brent Scowcroft, and others, are weighing in behind the scenes, alarmed apparently that the Bush administration may go to war against Iran and urging a dialogue with Iran. This could be interpreted as a kind of meltdown of U.S. foreign policy where President Bush needs adult supervision.
Yes, of course, a meltdown suggests that there was once a rigid and a defensible policy, and the fact is there's never really been that from the beginning of the 9/11 catastrophe, because within a very short time of 9/11, he he was embarking on policies that not only were not responsive to terrorism and the real threat of Al-Qaeda and this decentralized, global, interdependent network of terrorists, but instead was pursuing, what, old enemies, oil money, making up for things that hadn't happened a long time ago. And the result was a strategy that first in Afghanistan, which is quickly becoming destable again, and then much more effectively in Iraq, have created a disaster. Yes, there is some danger, one worries, given what these people are capable of, that they will march on to Iran. Fortunately, our troops are spread so thin, the National Guard now being also sent down to the Mexican border, that I think, frankly, the tactical possibility of an invasion of Iran is simply beyond the capabilities of the Pentagon and the National Guard. So I suspect that's mostly just blather and talk. But we have had, and that's what Europe worries about, we have seen blather and wild talk turn into policy. And the danger here is that they will, in effect, talk themselves into a corner where, if not an invasion, intervention from the air becomes a necessity simply because they have no other exit. And it's that that the Europeans are working very hard to try to avoid.
Ben Barber did, again, at the press conference with Bush and Blair. Blair was quite subdued, and he seemed somewhat irrelevant in a way. He then met with the United Nations and came up with a plan for what he calls progressive preemption.
Bush and Blair has been a lapdog relationship, and it's never been quite clear who's the lapdog and whose lap is being sat in. Certainly, in this last meeting, Blair was not reinforcing Bush, but Bush instead was kind of trying to keep the old British chin up, stiff upper lip for Blair. Blair is, of course, in deep trouble, not only because of Iraq, but because New Labour has run its course, because Gordon Brown has been waiting impatiently in the wings to assume power, because backbenchers in the Labour Party are pushing hard for Blair to exit ASAP. So he's got a lot of problems that have nothing to do with Iraq, though many of them can be traced to the disastrous and uncritical support for the American policies in Iraq. So Blair's problems certainly begin with his support for Bush's strategy, but now has taken on a life of its own, and that's why I think in a sense what Blair really was preoccupied. I mean, he really needed to be at 10 Downing, not in the White House, trying to deal with the attacks of the backbench labor folks who want Gordon Brown in today rather than next year. So it is a sad situation to see the leaders of the free world in such a kind of pathetic circumstance. But as I say, I don't think it's quite fair to say Iraq did it to them. They did it to themselves, despite the very good advice of an awful lot of people in both countries who were trying to suggest that maybe there were some alternatives to preemptive war.
And where do you think this is heading then, if they're essentially, one's a wounded, almost extinct duck, and the other one is a lame duck? Bush did make some unusual for him, or almost unprecedented for him, admitted mistakes, particularly regretted challenging the Iraqi insurgents to bring it on. But he's got almost as much time left as Jack Kennedy had.
Well, that's true. Of course, he's also got a Secretary of State in Condoleezza Rice, who is a quite different person and has been taking a much more, some would call it, probably dismissively, European approach to diplomacy by insisting on talk, on negotiations, on listening. And actually, she's done a fairly good job of pushing Bush to, I think, take a more diplomatic track. I think the good news for America is that we have neither the financial nor the military capabilities right now to open new fronts. So even though there are those who would love to open them in Iran or Syria or elsewhere, the reality is that's unlikely to happen. And what we might actually see in the next couple of years are the sorts of things we saw in the White House: Bush pulling back, using more diplomatic language, unleashing Condi Rice to follow a more diplomatic negotiation tactic. We've seen now even the possibility of reopening the idea of talks bilateral talks with Iran, and that's, of course, what Iran wanted. By the way, North Korea has also asked for bilateral talks, and both in North Korea and Iran, Bush has refused them. In both cases, what we might see, out of weakness, not strength, is a reopening of those talks, and actually the possibility of some real progress, and if not progress, at least the avoidance of nuclear confrontation with North Korea or with Iran. So, frankly, the weakness at this point, combined with the incapacity of the Pentagon and the absence of financial resources to back the Pentagon, suggests to me that we might have a slightly less rocky road in the next 2 years on the way to the Democrats retaking the White House and Congress.
And Ben Barber, obviously, the situation in Iran is largely our making in the extent to which this invasion of Iraq has destroyed Iraq, but strengthened Iran and put them in the catbird seat. It's worth noting that when the statue of Saddam fell on April the 10th of 2003, the Iranians came to the White House through a back channel, hat in hand, begging for the United States to negotiate with them. Everything is on the table. We have the authority from the Supreme Leader, they told the White House. They clearly were worried that they'd be next. And guess what happened on our side? Cheney and Rumsfeld said, we don't talk to evil. Well, evil won. Evil's now in the catbird seat.
Well,
I mean, these people are absolute incompetence. They ought to be pilloried for their arrogance and incompetence.
No, that is the real irony here is that, in fact, prior to the, if you go back even a little further, prior to the invasion of Iraq, the Democracy Front, the middle class, the bourgeoisie in Iran, the new democratic movement there under Khatami and others, was making real headway and was really beginning to feel its oats. And, of course, the invasion of Iraq cut them off at the knees and empowered the most conservative wing of the mullahs and the imams in Iran. And then, of course, secondarily, as you said, once, in fact, Baghdad fell, there was a second opportunity that we didn't take up. And the third thing that we're really missing, and this is just crazy because Bush, of all people, ought to understand it. I mean, Bush is a man of great national pride. He's played on the pride of being an American and what America has a right to expect. Why don't we recognize that other nations have the same pride? What's going on in Iran right now is that all kinds of Iranians, including pro-American Iranians, including anti-Iman, anti-religious Iranians, are taking pride in the capacity of Iran to develop a peaceful nuclear program, and indeed, if it needs them, to develop weapons. We are taking this as some kind of crazy episode on the part of a psychotic leader rather than an expression of national pride on the part of all Iranians. And, of course, once again, we've been surprised to find out that the left and the center has been supporting the religious right in terms of nuclear energy in Iran because it's a point of national pride. And Iranians say if America and Israel and France and England and now India and Pakistan can have nuclear weapons, why can't we at least have a nuclear program and possibly nuclear weapons as well? That doesn't mean we necessarily simply cave. It does mean we recognize the pride behind that and recognize that simply saying to them, no, you can't, Daddy America says that's not going to happen, is a perfect way to organize and centralize Iranians into a mass audience of Persians who will see America as their enemy. In other words, we once again are creating enemies where we had none, are inciting national pride against us where there was none, and we've actually now, I think, made the coming of nuclear weapons inevitable in Iran, because by saying you can't have them, we all of Iran say, well, then we're going to get them. So once again, as you say, Ian, we have a counterproductive, clumsy, and ultimately ineffective foreign policy that's bringing into being the very things that the policies supposedly were designed to avoid.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Benjamin Barber, obviously we wouldn't have had this catastrophe in Iraq, or at least we may not have had this catastrophe in Iraq, had there been a democratic opposition in this country that in effect the Democrats were rolled by the October 03 war resolution vote still today, some of their front runners, Kerry and Edwards, are haunted by that vote. In the face of a lethal foreign policy, a combination of arrogance and incompetence, you would think that there would be an alternative foreign policy being proffered somewhere.
Well, we have a lot to answer for, those of us who are Democrats and who are progressives. I mean, to this day, we know that Hillary Clinton continues to play the hawk card, and there are a lot of other congressmen who have done the same. The fact is, as you rightly say, we have not had anything like a sensible and thoughtful alternative foreign policy. And until we do, I think not just Republicans and Bush, but Democrats have a great deal to answer for. And I think one of the problems of the upcoming congressional elections, Democrats will certainly make major inroads, and of the presidential election in 08, where we have a good chance to win the White House, I think is the absence of thoughtful, inventive, forward-looking thinking that really provides an alternative that sees the United States as part of an interdependent world with partners that, like it or not, it has to deal with. And until we begin to create foreign policies that recognize interdependence, that recognize the ways in which the world has changed from the Cold War, we are going to be caught up in policies that aren't just Bush's fault, but are the fault of all Americans. So it's really up to us, I think, to start doing some fresh, hard, and creative thinking. And maybe it could start with Hillary Clinton and some of the other leading Democrats like Kerry, who up until now have not really shown themselves capable of thinking in fresh terms about these very old and sad subjects.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Benjamin Barber.
Great to talk with you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Here speaking then with Benjamin Barber, who is a distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland, a principal in the Democracy Collaborative. He is the author of the prescient international bestseller Jihad versus McWorld, and more recently, Fierce Empire, War, Terrorism, and Democracy. I'm now speaking with Robert Malley, who is Middle East and North Africa Program Director at the International Crisis Group. Prior to that, Robert Malley served as assistant to President Clinton for Arab-Israeli affairs, and prior to that, the executive assistant to Samuel Berger, President Clinton's national security advisor, and he was also the director of democracy for democracy, human rights, and humanitarian affairs on the National Security Council. And this early in the week, President Bush met with Ehud Olmert, the new Israeli prime minister, and in the midst of the press conference, the joint press conference, the president appeared to sort of almost off the cuff offer up a what amounts to a treaty with Israel, saying that if Israel were attacked, the United States would come to Israel's defense. Clearly, treaties have to be offered up in a deliberative way and eventually ratified by the United States Senate. Do you think it's time for a treaty, or was this just a sort of offhand remark?
Well, you know, it's not the first time. He's already alluded to it before in what may have been more of an off-the-cuff remark a few months ago, in which he said that if Israel were attacked by Iran, the U.S. would come to its defense. In some way, it's not a surprise. I think most people would expect the U.S. to act that way, even though there is no formal defense treaty, and it is, I guess, as the U.S. sees it, it's a way to ensure that Israel doesn't take matters in its own hands and tries to preempt Iran's nuclear program by waging a war on its own. This is a form of assurance telling the Israelis that the U.S. will be there with them in the event something happened. So, you know, at some point, U.S. presidents have considered in the past entering into a treaty with Israel. Had a peace agreement been reached between Israel and the Palestinians in the year 2000, when President Clinton was in office, that was one of the things President Clinton would have offered. But even, you know, even without a treaty, I think most people who follow this would expect that that would be the U.S. attitude. If they were attacked, certainly by a nuclear-armed Iran, the U.S. would come to its defense.
Should this be something that's debated, though?
At some point, it should probably be enshrined in some kind of mutual defense treaty. I think most U.S. presidents would wait for other things to happen, such as a broader Middle East peace, before we took that kind of step. And, I mean, it is normally the kind of thing that would be deliberated at in the Senate, and in which Americans would have a point of view. I think in this case, it would be pretty non-controversial. I think that doesn't mean that one should dispense with debate, but I think most senators would certainly readily agree that if Israel were attacked, the U.S. should side with it, certainly in the event of an Iranian attack. But, you know, the main question now is not, it's not so much what do we do if Iran attacks, it's what do we do vis-a-vis Iran in order to make sure that it doesn't come to that. And that's where I think the administration is more vulnerable to criticism. Rather than talk about coming to Israel's defense, rather than talk about perhaps even taking other action to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear program, we should be talking about talking to Iran to try to see if there isn't a way to resolve this diplomatically before it gets too late.
Well, apparently, Robert Malley, there's been some international pressure and pressure from elder statesmen here in the United States, such as Henry Kissinger, and apparently the German leader also has been working behind the scenes. So what, to your mind, is the level of anxiety vis-a-vis an Israeli preemption? As there's been talk about it happening sometime in the summer, there's also Seymour Hersh did a long piece suggesting that there are elaborate plans on our side to go this route. And apparently, one reads in the New York Times, the LA Times, stories suggesting that this anxiety has motivated these elder statesmen to come out of the woodwork.
Well, I think it's elder statesmen, and the main point is it's not just Democrats, it's also Republicans. It's Henry Kissinger, it's Brent Scowcroft, it's even members of the Senate, Republican leaders of the Senate, who are saying, they say it may come to military action. I think military action would be folly. Certainly, it should never be contemplated lightly in this circumstance, but their argument is, before you come to that, let's exhaust every diplomatic means. One of the reasons why Iran may be doing what it's doing is because it feels surrounded, besieged by U.S. troops in Iraq, U.S. troops in Afghanistan, by a nuclear-armed Pakistan, by a nuclear-armed India. Let's at least test whether those are their real concerns and whether they could be appeased through a dialogue with the U.S., in which the U.S. would have to put some things on the table. I think that's their argument. Let's at least go through that and before concluding that diplomacy has failed, because I think most people who've looked at this have concluded that there's no way the Europeans, to whom we've really delegated the task of negotiating with Iran, have what the Iranians are looking for. So this is a dysfunctional negotiation to begin with. If the Iranians are looking for security guarantees, if they're looking for the end of U.S. economic sanctions, if they're looking for some recognition of their regional role, none of those things can be given to them by the Europeans. The U.S. is the only country that could offer them and could provide those things to Iran. So if one really wants to test what Iran's intentions are, let's at least have a fair negotiation between the Iranians and the party about with whom they really want to start talking to.
Well, I think a lot of analysts suggest that the intervention in Iraq has done nothing but weaken Iraq and put it on the brink of civil war, or perhaps already there's an incipient civil war. And conversely, it has strengthened Iran. Apparently, back in the 10th of April of 2003, when the statue of Saddam was toppled, the Iranians, through back channels, did approach the White House saying, look, we want to talk about anything and everything's on the table. Our authority comes from the supreme leader. And apparently, both Rumsfeld and Cheney gave them the back of the hand, suggesting that we don't talk to evil. Well, guess what? Evil won. I mean, now they're in the catbird seat.
I mean, it is paradoxical, isn't it, that we went to war against Iraq for all kinds of reasons, and we never found the weapons of mass destruction in the country that is developing them and seems to be developing them, at least the capacity to develop them. Iran is in a much stronger position, not only in the nuclear file, by the way, but also in Iraq itself, where its influence is great, getting greater every day as the U.S. influence probably diminishes every day. So that's just only one of the paradoxes and ironies of the war, that it has strengthened the country that we now say is at the top, the administration says, is at the top of the list of threats to our national security. So I think that's certainly one observation. The other one, which you're correct to point out, is that there seem to have been moments in the past, times in the past, when the Iranians did want to engage in some kind of dialogue with us. I mean, nobody knows whether those would have succeeded or not, and I don't want to sound as if I believe that the Iranians only want to have good relations with the U.S. There certainly are some other motivations behind it. But both in the wake of the Afghan war, where we had begun to talk to the Iranians, and they seem to want to carry that dialogue further, and as you say, after the war in Iraq, there's now coming out more and more information about a possible offer by the Iranians for some kind of back-channel talks with the U.S., and those purportedly were rebuffed by the administration. And now, several years later, Iran is stronger. We are weaker, at least in Iraq, and now it's become more imperative, in fact, for us to resolve this issue. So there's been enough opportunities that have been missed. And I think, really, the Bush administration faces a real choice now. If they are serious about trying to go down the diplomatic route rather than simply use it as a pretext to then move on to something else, they're going to have to decide how to engage the Iranians, whether they do it in the context of the talks that are taking place between the Europeans and the Iranians, or if they want to do it bilaterally. Either way, they need to show, and I think they need to do it for our own interest, that they're serious about trying to see whether there is some kind of middle road, some compromise that can be found between the Iranian regime and the U.S.
In today's New York Times, there's a lead article suggesting that Ahmadinejad, the Iranian leader, is in fact consolidating power. And apparently, the interpretation is that he has the support and blessing of the supreme leader, Khamenei, and is acting aggressively on a number of fronts to become a real leader in a country that's had a kind of opaque kind of leadership structure since the passing of Khomeini. So what do you make of that?
Well, one of the messages, I mean, one of the messages that's coming out from Iranians now, people who say they have close ties to the regime, is that, in fact, the supreme leader is more in control, Khamenei is more in control than he's ever been, because he doesn't have a dual government. He doesn't have to contend with a more reformist president, as was the case for the last several years. Now, the degree to which Khamenei and the president, Ahmadinejad, are completely in sync, completely in agreement, is something that's very hard to judge from the outside. But there does seem objectively to be a greater ability of this Iranian regime to, in fact, strike a deal if they are interested in it, because they don't have to contend with another wing of power, the more reformist wing of power. Because what we saw happen in the past was every time the reformists, for example, tried to reach out to the U.S., they would be attacked by the more conservative forces, and so they would checkmate each other, and there was no way, neither side wanted the other one to be able to claim credit for a breakthrough in relations with the U.S. If, in fact, you are seeing a consolidation of power in Iran in the hands of both the supreme leader and the president, it may, in fact, be, despite all the negative implications that has about a more conservative leadership in Iran, the positive lesson or the positive implication is that they may, in fact, be empowered to strike the kind of bolder deal that has eluded Iran and the U.S. since the Iranian Revolution.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Robert Malley, who was President Clinton's special assistant for Arab-Israeli affairs on the National Security Council. And clearly, Iran has played a role and is continuing to play a role in the Palestinian-Israeli situation. Going back to the 1996 elections, arguably the Iranians, revolutionaries, decided the outcome of the 1980 election here in the United States, the extent to which the hostages were returned, that Carter was twisting in the wind and they delivered the hostages to Reagan. That's an argument for another day. But Shimon Peres feels that it was the Iranian influence in the 1996 elections that helped elect Netanyahu and scuttle the Oslo Accords and begin the Intifada. So why is it, given your long involvement with the Arab, with the Israeli-Palestinian issue, Robert Malley, why have the Israelis allowed the Iranians effectively to meddle in their backyard? And now that everybody's cutting off funds to Hamas, which clearly has relationships with the Iranians, it sort of brings that into stark focus that, you know, it's the reason that Hamas got elected was they're actually delivering services to the people, whereas Fatah was corrupt and delivering services to themselves. So it's just a general broad kind of puzzlement on my part as to why the Iranians have been allowed by default to have so much influence in this tortured situation.
Yeah, and I think one has to distinguish between two things. It's true that Iran has and has growing influence in the Palestinian theater, whether directly through its assistance to some groups like Islamic Jihad or others, or indirectly through its support to the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, which reportedly is now more active as well in the Palestinian territory. So I think there is a more aggressive Iranian foreign policy that wants to expand its influence throughout the region and use that leverage in order to get what it wants on other issues. I think one would be wrong to exaggerate that influence. I think what we're seeing on the Palestinian side and the victory of Hamas and Hamas's growing strength is really an endogenous, a Palestinian development, and not not decided in Tehran, and their policies are not decided by Tehran, even though there may be close relations between some members of the Hamas leadership and the Iranian leadership. But we really are dealing in the Israeli-Palestinian theater with homegrown developments, the fact that Palestinians were obviously, as you say, fed up with Fatah's leadership. They felt that they hadn't delivered on the two things that they had promised to deliver. Number one was statehood, and they never got that. And number two was good administration, good governance, and they didn't get that either. So on both scores, they lost. So in hindsight, it's not that surprising that the major opposition group, Hamas, prevailed. The other thing that was going for Hamas was they really stood as people voting for Hamas could express their defiance not only of Fatah, but also of Israel, also of the international community, and of a peace process that they felt had led them nowhere. So Hamas was a vote for Palestinians, their way of sending a message to say, we've had enough of everything that's happened to us over the last 10 years, and we're not going to show you by voting for people who have been steadfast and who have rejected everything that has happened to us over the last decade. So I think Iran does have now a greater ability to influence what's happening, but it would be a mistake to exaggerate that influence. If one wants to handle the Israeli-Palestinian issue, one is going to have to handle the questions that arise from Israel's occupation of the West Bank, Palestinian aspirations, but also Palestinian violence and in some cases terrorism. That's going to have to be dealt with on its own. And of course, if you deal with it well, you'll be able to limit Iran's ability to influence events outside. But the real address is in the West Bank and in Gaza, not in Tehran.
But Robert Malley, we've been in the occupation business, 3, going on 4 years now in Iraq, and it's been a catastrophe because essentially we didn't deliver. And the Israelis have been in there for about 40 years. So I guess it's, in hindsight, it's kind of worthless to have this discussion, but you can't help feeling that the longer this thing has been dragging on, the less chance there has been to have anybody on the Palestinian side that you can talk to. I mean, now we're at a critical juncture where the Abu Mazen, the president, has basically had to give Hamas an ultimatum vis-a-vis recognizing Israel. So it seems to me that we're running out of options here.
Well, we've been running out of options. I mean, the whole history of trying to find the right Palestinian interlocutor has been a history of attempts to find people who are more, how could I put it, consistent with either Israeli views or other views, and it's never worked. I think there's a lesson to be drawn there, but I think that what's really happened on the Israeli-Palestinian arena over the last few years has been a complete transformation of all the basic precepts and pillars assumptions that have been driving it for the last decade. Number one, as you say on the Palestinian side, you no longer have at least a monopoly of Fatah, of the secular nationalists. Hamas is at least a very strong rival and is now in control of the government and represents a good portion of the Palestinian people, and they have an ideology which is very different from the nationalist secular ideology. They refuse to endorse the notion of of an end of the conflict with Israel. They may accept a long-term truce, a long-term ceasefire, but they are not prepared to agree that once you negotiate with Israel, at the end of the day, you're going to accept Israel's legitimacy. So that's one development. Another one is chaos, fragmentation, possible civil war on the Palestinian side, which is both a result of Hamas's rise and the result of the war that's been taking place, the Intifada and Israel's military retaliation since the year 2000. The other development is on the Israeli side, where people have also turned away from negotiations in their own minds and now believe that Israel should, on its own, basically decide, withdraw from Palestinian territory and decide what are secure, defensible borders for them. And then on the part of the international community, and in the U.S. in particular, you've seen with the Bush administration sort of peace process fatigue, a sense that this conflict is not going to be resolved right now. At best, it could be managed, and therefore much less intrusive, much less robust diplomacy to try to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. All those elements have led us to where we are now, where, in my view, the best that one could hope for is to stabilize the situation, prevent a resumption of violence between Israelis and Palestinians, and prevent a civil war between among Palestinians, which would be obviously a disaster for the Palestinians and set their national cause back decades, but would also, I suspect, be a disaster for Israel, because it's very hard to imagine containing Palestinian-on-Palestinian violence to within Palestinian borders. Very quickly, it would spill over into Israel. Militant groups would say that would take advantage of it to start resuming attacks against Israel. We may already be seeing signs of it. So I think, even though in my heart I wish that we could move now towards the kind of settlement that President Clinton had in mind and others have broached, a real full-scale settlement between Israelis and Palestinians, that may be too tall an order today. But let's at least prevent the worst from happening, real chaos and hunger and collapse of the Palestinian Authority and a resumption of Israeli-Palestinian violence. And I think we can do that. It can be achieved if each side is prepared to make do and make some accommodations and not stick to ideological inflexible positions. And that means Hamas has to moderate its position, Israel has to moderate its position, and the U.S. also has to moderate its position so that you, as I say, you prevent a resumption of full-scale violence.
Well, just in closing, Robert Malley, I think you could add to that grim scenario, not just the possibility of a Fatah-Hamas civil war and that bleeding into the regional civil wars or taking advantage of the situation. I mean, there are many that argued that the neoconservatives who were behind the architects of the Iraq invasion were somehow carrying the Likud's water. It seems to me that if the civil war in Iraq becomes more open, and then it's to some extent it's already a surrogate war with the Iranians on one side and the Sunni Saudis and Jordanians on the other. Arguably, at this point, Iraq is actually President Bush has achieved in I'm saying that with great irony, has to move Al Qaeda 1,000 miles closer to Europe and possibly move Al Qaeda within a couple of 100 miles of Israel's border.
Well, I think the picture you're painting is really one that should give everyone reason to pause, and in particular, people in the United States who are thinking about what is the right foreign policy, Middle East policy that the next administration needs to develop. And the harm that's been done in the region, number one, obviously the war in Iraq, but also our disengagement from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, some of our positions on Iran. There's a whole slew of positions and policies that have undermined U.S. policy, discredited U.S. initiatives, and led the region closer to internal chaos than it's been in quite some time. Now, this is not an argument for returning to the status quo. There were real problems with the status quo, as we saw on September 11th. But the kind of reckless policies that have been put in place without any real serious regard for consequences, for the day after, and that's really a theme, I think, that cuts across our policies in the region. We never thought about the day after in Iraq. We don't seem to be thinking about the day after in the Palestinian case. What if Hamas and the Palestinian Authority collapse? Do we actually think that is going to serve the interests of the region or U.S. interests in the region? And what about the day after of a possible military strike in Iran? In all those cases, there are a series of principles that seem to be guiding policy, but there seems to be no policy, no strategic sense of where we're going and how we prevent Iraq from descending into absolute civil war, the Palestinians descending into civil war, perhaps a resumption of Israeli-Palestinian hostilities, perhaps either the development of a nuclear-armed Iran or military operations to prevent that outcome. On all these fronts, we're seeing the indicators pointing in the wrong direction, and I think we're going to need a very fresh look from whoever will come into office in 2008. And the good part of the job, the good news is that the bar will be set so low that almost anything new will be viewed positively in the region. The bad news or the difficult challenge will be that so much has gone wrong that it's going to take an awful lot to put the pieces of the puzzle back together.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Robert Malley.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Marcus. I'm just speaking then with Robert Malley, who was President Clinton's Special Assistant for Arab-Israeli Affairs on the National Security Council. I'm now speaking to Tim Goodrich, who enlisted in the Air Force at the age of 18. He was deployed in the Middle East three times during his enlistment and participated in the intensified bombing of Iraq during the fall of 2002. That was the period when secretly President Bush and Tony Blair were trying to goad the Iraqis into war. And Tim Goodrich returned to Iraq in January of 2004 with the Global Exchange and a fact-finding delegation, and he is a co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Joining him is Mike, who was born and raised in Los Angeles. He joined the California National Guard at the age of 17. He was deployed in Iraq in September of 2004, and remained there until October of 2005, and he's actually still in the California National Guard. Tim Goodrich, this being Memorial Day, obviously it's a good time to talk to veterans, and regrettably we are at war again, and as the World War II generation dies off, younger vets as yourself produced every day, so it's not as if the West, the countries, fought a war to end all wars, but this was a different war in as much as it was a preemptive war, not necessarily a necessary war. What was your sense there in the beginning of that war, of amongst your fellow soldiers, of how different it is to go to war when the country, your country's not attacked, and essentially this is an optional war on the part of the president, who, let's be frank, wasn't very clear to the American people or even to himself about what his reasons were?
Well, the thing is, at the beginning there, a lot of my people that were in the unit with me, they were ramped up and ready to go into the war because of what they were hearing on TV. Whereas me, I took a little more time, I think, than the average person to look into all the dealings we had with Iraq and our foreign policy dealing with them over the course of not just the previous couple of years, but the entire last century, and how it tied in with oil and the whole power strategies that were playing in the Middle East. So I was a small minority when I was over there, and the rhetoric was increasing to go into Iraq. But I think over time, more and more of the people in my unit have kind of come around and realized that this war is not the right war, not the right time, not the right country. And you also have to keep in mind that being in the Air Force, we're a couple hundred miles away from the action a large part of the time. So we have less to lose, and there's kind of a disconnect there almost. It's a lot easier to drop bombs on people from a distance than it is to pull the trigger of an M16 when you're facing somebody eye to eye.
Well, indeed, but it turns out now that the Air Force is now training its enlisted men in combat because the lines are so blurred in Iraq now. Let me turn to Mike. You were just in Iraq as recently as October of last year. Tim was in the early part when this was a popular war, and where most of the people in the country, including the Democrats in opposition, went along with this war, and there was a lot of sort of excitement and jingoism. But you've been there in the time when things have turned quite quite negatively. Give us an update on the prevailing feelings about the mission, if there's indeed a consensus amongst the soldiers.
Well, there is no exact consensus amongst the soldiers. There is, I was saying, there is about maybe 20% feel that, you know, that the war is just. You have about 60% who lie in the middle, and you have the 20% who feel that the war is unjust, and it was for nothing more than oil and profiteering. What I saw in Iraq, I oversaw three elections. I oversaw the first election in January, through the election in October, and the election in December. That, you know, that brought, you know, the Iraqi parliament into power. And what I also saw during that time period was the strategy change from the Iraqi insurgents stop attacking the U.S. soldiers and start attacking the Iraqis themselves.
So, but your California National Guard unit has had a pretty rough time, probably not quite as bad as the Columbus, Ohio Marine Reserves in Al Anbar, but still, you've been in Al Anbar, isn't that where the California National Guard is?
California National Guard is, well, from when I was there, was stationed in Crete, Iraq, which was, you know, right in the center of the country, right, which is about 80 miles north of Baghdad. And we did see our fair share of mortars and rocket attacks, but, you know, our mission was essentially support and, you know, to make sure that we saw through combat operations.
But what's happening in terms of the tactics? Because clearly, every time you go out on a road, you're vulnerable to IEDs. The supply route from Kuwait up to all the way up to Baghdad, which is the main supply artery, goes through Shiite country, and so far the Shiites haven't really turned against us. So, but the BIAP run, the Baghdad, like it's called Irish, the run into the green zone is constantly beset with IEDs, and it seems like every time anybody goes out on patrol in vehicles, they're vulnerable, and I keep hearing from soldiers in Iraq that for every guy that's killed or wounded by an IED, I think four or five times everybody else has been blown up. In other words, everybody's experienced these explosions, which they're not even sure how much damage they do to your brain, since the tremendous shock wave shakes up your brain. So, in other words, I guess it's a long-winded way of saying that casualties are much worse than I think meets the eye.
Yes, you are correct. One of our biggest fears was IEDs. When I took my ride north, going from Kuwait to Crete, we prepared our trucks using improvised armor. And what I mean by this is that we cut up plates of steel to give us protection. Otherwise, we'd have no protection around our trucks and Humvees. And this was immediately after Rumsfeld came to the region, to Kuwait. And, and Specialist Wilson asked him the question, is why is that, you know, we're the largest army in the world with, you know, the most resources, and we have to, you know, scrounge around dumps to look for, you know, armor and, you know, all this. And Rumsfeld replied, well, you don't go to war with the armor you want. You go to war with the armor you have. And, you know, an immediate backlash from that was that civilians got to see firsthand what we deal with on a regular basis. And what we deal with is the fact that you're told that this is the equipment that you have, and you make it work. And so what we did is that we found that we were given, you know, plates of steel and templates to cut for our Humvees and our larger trucks, and put them in strategic places so that if an IED did go off, we would have at least some protection, better than none. When I took my ride north, I was in a open cab vehicle. So if the IED did go off, then I would probably be blown clear from it. But the threat of an IED never left our mind, even when we were in the southern part of Iraq. Because even in the southern part of Iraq, you're more worried about them setting off an IED to steal with the equipment that's left over that you leave behind when you leave the scene, rather than, you know, anything else. But once you get into the southern part of Baghdad and come start going through Baghdad, your hair stands up on end, and you become more aware of everything that's happening around you, especially because the route that I took, I went through a place called Camp Cook, which is actually probably near Abu Ghraib. And when we went through that area, we were pretty much on the very end of our wits to make sure that that everybody came home safely and that everybody made it through that mission.
Well, it is unconscionable that this has been so evident for so long, over 3 years now, that this is the principal weapon of the enemy, the IED, and it is the principal cause of casualties, and often horrific casualties involving amputations. And as I mentioned, for all the times that people aren't killed, they're still blown up multiple times, and there's no understanding, or at least no clarity on what damage that does. Let me just turn to Tim Goodrich. Why did you join this, I guess it's an anti-war group that you're a co-founder of, Iraq Veterans Against the War?
Well, the reason it was formed is after I did that research into our past dealings with Iraq and our overall larger foreign policy, I came to realize that any war in Iraq would be wrong. And then after going to Iraq and seeing the other side of the bombing as a civilian when I was in Baghdad, I was just appalled that this was being done in my name, and I felt compelled to speak out. I had no other choice. My conscience wouldn't let me stay quiet. So I got in touch with one of the other co-founders, Mike Hoffman. We were speaking at the same event on the first anniversary in Dover, Delaware, right outside the gates of Dover Air Force Base, where all the bodies come home. And we got this idea to form an organization, and over the course of the next couple of months, we met a couple other like-minded people, and then in July 2004, we decided that the nine of us, we had to go public because there was going to be a lot more of us. And you know what? There are a lot more of us, whether they're in Iraq right now, whether they're facing a deployment or just returning. There's a lot of active-duty soldiers that are against this war, and I think that's very evident when you take a look at the poll that the Military Times just did recently, showing that 72% of the soldiers want the troops home from Iraq by the end of 2006, and 29% want them home immediately.
Well, just we're having to wrap up here, running out of time, unfortunately. Tim, a lot of the vets have difficulty getting employment. What have you been doing since you got back from Iraq?
Well, I've taken a little different route than I think most people have, and I've turned to politics, which is kind of ironic because I was never political growing up, and even more ironic is the fact that I voted for Bush in 2000, and now I'm working in the progressive Democrat arena. And what I'm doing right now is I'm actually working for Marcy Winograd. She's running against Jane Harmon in the 36th Congressional District, and she has a strong anti-war platform.
And that's actually, I read an article in the LA Times about that race between Harmon and Marcy Winograd, where Jane Harmon is positioning herself as the realist and by default suggesting that Marcy Winograd is an idealist. But the irony is that the realists got Iraq wrong and the idealists got Iraq right.
That's right. Everything that the quote unquote liberals were predicting before the war has come true. And I just wanted to say, too, it's a mixture of things that are going to bring our troops home. I advocate more political involvement from the grassroots. And also, the troops themselves are the people that are going to bring them home, because they're eventually, just like Vietnam, they're going to lose the will to fight. And one of the things that Iraq Veterans Against the War is doing is we're sending 500 free copies that we've secured of the new documentary, Sir, No, Sir, over to troops in Iraq so that they can see that this has all been done before, that it's okay for soldiers to speak out in light of an immoral war. So if people want to request a free DVD to be sent to their loved one or their friend over in Iraq or whoever might be on active duty that they know, they can go to our website at ivaw.org and request that.
Just in closing then, Mike, you're still in the California National Guard. Of course, Mike's not your real name. What's your sense of the anti-Iraq war movement amongst the vets and amongst those serving?
Well, the numbers can really be seen by who reenlists. by the numbers of reenlistment that are coming back, you know, to serve in either the National Guard, the active duty, or the reserve. And the numbers have been low for the last couple of years because those who have faced the deployment don't want to face it again.
Well, I thank you both for joining us here on Memorial Day, Tim Goodrich and Mike.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Tim Goodrich, who served in the early part of the Iraq War, went back as a civilian in January of 2004, and he's a co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and Mike, who is not his real name, he's in the California National Guard. He's still in the Guard. He just got back from Iraq after 11 months in October of 2005, I think. Lewis Mandelberg, the producer, Jess Shepard, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer.